His eyes are closed. His face is gray. His hair plastered in a smooth smear across his forehead, as though done with a paintbrush. His face appears sunken a little, sagging from the bony ridges of eye sockets, nose, gums, as though the wetting had slacked the firmness which had held the skin full. His teeth, set in pale gums, are parted a little, as if he had been laughing quietly. He lies pole-thin in his wet clothes, a little pool of vomit at his head, and a thread of it running from the corner of his mouth and down his cheek, where he couldn't turn his head quick or far enough, until Dewey Dell stoops and wipes it away with the hem of her dress. Jewel approaches. He has the plane. "Vernon just found the square," he says. He looks down at Cash, dripping too. "Ain't he talked none yet?" "He had his saw and hammer and chalk line and rule," I say. "I know that." Jewel lays the square down. Pa watches him. "They can't be far away," Pa says. "It all went together. Was there e'er a such misfortunate man?" Jewel does not look at Pa. "You better call Vardaman back here," he says. He looks at Cash. Then he turns and goes away. "Get him to talk as soon as he can," he says, "so he can tell us what else there was." We return to the river. The wagon is hauled clear, the wheels chocked, carefully. We all helped. It is as though upon the shabby, familiar, inert shape of the wagon there lingered somehow, latent yet still immediate, that violence which had slain the mules that drew it not an hour since, above the edge of the flood. In the wagon bed it lies profoundly, the long, pale planks hushed a little with wetting, yet still yellow, like gold seen through water, save for two long, muddy smears. We pass it and go on to the bank. One end of the rope is made fast to a tree. At the edge of the stream, knee-deep, Vardaman stands, bent forward a little, watching Vernon with rapt absorption. He has stopped yelling, and he is wet to the armpits. Vernon is at the other end of the rope, shoulder deep in the river, looking back at Vardaman.
"Further back than that," he says. "You get back by the tree and hold the rope for me so it can't slip."
Vardaman backs along the rope to the tree, moving blindly, watching Vernon. When we come up, he looks at us once, his eyes round and a little dazed. Then he looks at Vernon again, in that posture of rapt alertness.
"I got the hammer, too," Vernon says. "Looks like we ought to done already got that chalk line. It ought to floated."
"Floated clean away," Jewel says. "We won't get it. We ought to find the saw, though."
"I reckon so," Vernon says. He looks at the water. "That chalk line, too. What else did he have?"
"He ain't talked yet," Jewel says, entering the water.
He looks back at me.
"You go back and get him roused up to talk," he says.
"Pause there," I say. I follow Jewel into the water, along the rope. It feels alive in my hand, bellied faintly in a prolonged and resonant arc. Vernon is watching me.
"You better go," he says. "You better be there."
"Let's see what else we can get before it washes on down," I say. We hold to the rope, the current curling and dimpling about our shoulders. But beneath that false blandness, the true force of it leans against us lazily. I had not thought that water in July could be so cold. It is like hands molding and prodding at the very bones. Vernon is still looking back toward the bank.
"Reckon it'll hold us all?" he says.
We too look back, following the rigid bar of the rope as it rises from the water to the tree, and Vardaman crouched a little beside it, watching us.
"Wish my mule wouldn't strike out for home," Vernon says.
"Come on," Jewel says. "Let's get out in here."
We submerge in turn,
holding to the rope, being clutched by one another while the cold wall of the water sucks the slanting mud backward and upstream from beneath our feet, and we are suspended so, groping along the cold bottom. Even the mud there is not still. It has a chill, scouring quality, as though the earth under us were in motion too. We touch and fumble at one another's extended arms, letting ourselves go cautiously against the rope, or, erect in turn, watch the water suck and boil where one of the other two gropes beneath the surface. Pa has come down to the shore, watching us. Vernon comes up, streaming, his face sloped down into his pursed, blowing mouth. His mouth is bluish, like a circle of weathered rubber. He has the rule. "He'll be glad of that," I say. "It's right new. He bought it just last month out of the catalog." "If we just knowed for sure what else," Vernon says, looking over his shoulder and then turning to face where Jewel had disappeared. "Didn't he go down for me?" Vernon says. "I don't know," I say. "I think so. Yes. Yes, he did." We watch the thick, curling surface streaming away from us in slow whirls. "Give him a pull on the rope," Vernon says. "He's on your end of it," I say. "Ain't nobody on my end of it," he says. "Pull it in," I say. But he has already done that, holding the end above the water. And then we see Jewel. He is 10 yards away. He comes up, blowing, and looks at us, tossing his long hair back with a jerk of his head. Then he looks toward the bank. We can see him filling his lungs. "Jewel," Vernon says, not loud, but his voice going full and clear along the water, peremptory yet tactful. "It'll be back here. Better come back." Jewel dives again. We stand there, leaning back against the current, watching the water where he disappeared, holding the dead rope between us like two men holding the nozzle of a fire hose, waiting for the water. Suddenly, Dewey Dell is behind us in the water.
"You make him come back," she says. "Jewel," she says.
He comes up again, tossing his hair back from his eyes. He is swimming now toward the bank, the current sweeping him downstream, quartering.
"You, Jewel,"
Dewey Dell says. We stand holding the rope and see him gain the bank and climb out. As he rises from the water, he stoops and picks up something. He comes back along the bank. He has found the chalk line. He comes opposite us and stands there, looking about as if he were seeking something. Pa goes on down the bank. He is going back to look at the mules again, where their round bodies float and rub quietly together in the slack water within the bend.
"What did you do with the hammer, Vernon?" Jewel says.
"I give it to him,"
Vernon says, jerking his head at Vardaman. Vardaman is looking after Pa. Then he looks at Jewel.
"With the square."
Vernon is watching Jewel. He moves toward the bank, passing Dewey Dell and me.
"You get on out of here," I say.
She says nothing, looking at Jewel and Vernon.
"Where's the hammer?"
Jewel says. Vardaman scuttles up the bank and fetches it.
"It's heavier than the saw," Vernon says.
Jewel is tying the end of the chalk line about the hammer shaft.
"Hammer's got the most wood in it," Jewel says.
He and Vernon face one another, watching Jewel's hands.
"And flatter, too," Vernon says. "It'd float 3-1 almost. Try the plane."
Jewel looks at Vernon. Vernon is tall, too. Long and lean, eye to eye, they stand in their close, wet clothes. Lon Quick could look even at a cloudy sky and tell the time to 10 minutes. Big Lon, I mean, not little Lon.
"Why don't you get out of the water?"
I say.
"It won't float like a saw," Jewel says.
"It'll float nigher to a saw than a hammer will,"
Vernon says.
"Betcha,"
Jewel says.
"I won't bet,"
Vernon says. They stand there, watching Jewel's still hands.
Hell, Jewel says. Get the plane, then.
So they get the plane and tie it to the chalk line and enter the water again. Pa comes back along the bank. He stops for a while and looks at us, hunched, mournful, like a failing steer or an old tall bird.
Vernon and Jewel return, leaning against the current.
Get out of the way, Jewel says to Dewey Dell. Get out of the water.
She crowds against me a little so they can pass, Jewel holding the plane high as though it were perishable, the blue string trailing back over his shoulder. They pass us and stop. They fall to arguing quietly about just where the wagon went over.
Darl ought to know, Vernon says.
They look at me.
I don't know, I says. I wasn't there that long.
Hell,
Jewel says. They move on gingerly, leaning against the current, reading the ford with their feet.
Have you got a hold to the rope?
Vernon says. Jewel does not answer. He glances back at the shore, calculant, then at the water. He flings the plane outward, letting the string run through his fingers turning blue where it runs over them. When the line stops, he hands it back to Vernon.
Better let me go this time,
Vernon says. Again, Jewel does not answer. We watch him duck beneath the surface.
Jewel,
Dewey Dell whimpers.
It ain't so deep there,
Vernon says. He does not look back. He is watching the water where Jewel went under. When Jewel comes up, he has the saw. When we pass the wagon, Pa is standing beside it, scrubbing at the two mud smears with a handful of leaves. Against the jungle, Jewel's horse looks like a patchwork quilt hung on a line. Cash is not moved. We stand above him, holding the plane, the saw, the hammer, the square, the rule, the chalk line, while Dewey Dell squats and lifts Cash's head.
Cash,
she says.
Cash.
He opens his eyes, staring profoundly up at our inverted faces.
If ever was such a misfortunate man,
Pa says. Look, Cash, we say, holding the tools up so he can see. What else did you have? He tries to speak, rolling his head, shutting his eyes.
Cash,
we say.
Cash.
It is to vomit he is turning his head. Dewey Dell wipes his mouth on the wet hem of her dress. Then he can speak.
It's his saw set, Jewel says. The new one he bought when he bought the rule.
He moves, turning away. Vernon looks up after him, still squatting. Then he rises and follows Jewel down to the water.
If ever was such a misfortunate man,
Pa says. He looms tall above us as we squat. He looks like a figure carved clumsily from tough wood by a drunken caricaturist.
It's a trial, he says, but I don't begrudge her it. No man can say I begrudge her it.
Dewey Dell has laid Cash's head back on the folded coat, twisting his head a little to avoid the vomit. Beside him his tools lie.
A fellow might call it lucky it was the same leg he broke when he fell off in that church,
Pa says.
But I don't begrudge her it.
Jewel and Vernon are in the river again. From here they do not appear to violate the surface at all. It is as though it had severed them both in a single blow, the two torsos moving with infinitesimal and ludicrous care upon the surface. It looks peaceful, like machinery does after you have watched it and listened to it for a long time, as though the clotting which is you had dissolved into the myriad original motion, and seeing and hearing in themselves blind and deaf, fury in itself, quiet with stagnation. Squatting, Dewey Dell's wet dress shapes for the dead eyes of three blind men those mammalian ludicrosities which are the horizons and the valleys of the earth.
Cash. It wasn't on a balance. I told them that if they wanted it to tote and ride on a balance, they would have to...
Cora. One day we were talking. She had never been pure religious, not even after that summer at the camp meeting, when Brother Whitfield wrestled with her spirit, singled her out and strove with the vanity in her mortal heart. And I said to her many a time, God gave you children to comfort your hard human lot, and for a token of his own suffering and love, for in love you conceived and bore them. I said that because she took God's love and her duty to him too much as a matter of course, and such conduct is not pleasing to him. I said, he gave us the gift to raise our voices in his undying praise, because I said there is more rejoicing in heaven over one sinner than over 100 that never sinned. And she said, my daily life is an acknowledgement and expiation of my sin. And I said, who are you to say what is sin and what is not sin? It is the Lord's part to judge, ours to praise his mercy and his holy name in the hearing of our fellow mortals, because he alone can see into the heart. And just because a woman's life is right in the sight of man, she can't know if there is no sin in her heart without she opens her heart to the Lord and receives his grace. I said, just because you have been a faithful wife is no sign that there is no sin in your heart. And just because your life is hard is no sign that the Lord's grace is absolving you. And she said, I know my own sin. I know that I deserve my punishment. I do not begrudge it. And I said, it is out of your vanity that you would judge sin and salvation in the Lord's place. It is our mortal lot to suffer and to raise our voices in praise of him who judges the sin and offers the salvation through our trials and tribulations, time out of mind. Amen. Not even after Brother Whitfield, a godly man, if ever one breathed God's breath, prayed for you and strove as never a man could except him, I said. Because it is not us that can judge our sins or know what is sin in the Lord's eyes. She has had a hard life, but so does every woman. But you'd think from the way she talked that she knew more about sin and salvation than the Lord God himself, than them who have strove and labored with the sin in this human world. When the only sin she ever committed was being partial to Jewel, that never loved her and was its own punishment, in preference to Darl that was touched by God himself and considered queer by us mortals and that did love her. I said, there is your sin. And your punishment, too. Jewel is your punishment. But where is your salvation? And life is short enough, I said, to win eternal grace in. And God is a jealous God. It is his to judge and to meet, not yours. I know, she said. Then she stopped, and I said, know what? Nothing, she said. He is my cross, and he will be my salvation. He will save me from the water and from the fire, even though I have laid down my life. He will save me. How do you know without you open your heart to him and lift your voice in his praise? I said. Then I realized that she did not mean God. I realized that out of the vanity of her heart she had spoken sacrilege. And I went down on my knees right there. I begged her to kneel and open her heart and cast from it the devil of vanity and cast herself upon the mercy of the Lord. But she wouldn't. She just sat there, lost in her vanity and her pride that had closed her heart to God and set that selfish mortal boy in his place. Kneeling there, I prayed for her. I prayed for that poor, blind woman as I had never prayed for me and mine.
Addie. In the afternoon, when school was out and the last one had left with his little dirty snuffling nose, instead of going home, I would go down the hill to the spring where I could be quiet and hate them. It would be quiet there then, with the water bubbling up and away and the sun slanting quiet in the trees and the quiet smelling of damp and rotting leaves and new earth, especially in the early spring, for it was worse then. I could just remember how my father used to say that the reason for living was to get ready to stay dead a long time. And when I would have to look at them day after day, each with his and her secret and selfish thought, and blood strange to each other blood and strange to mine, and think that this seemed to be the only way I could get ready to stay dead, I would hate my father for having ever planted me. I would look forward to the times when they faltered so I could whip them. When the switch fell, I could feel it upon my flesh. When it welted and ridged, it was my blood that ran. And I would think with each blow of the switch, now you are aware of me. Now I am something in your secret and selfish life who have marked your blood with my own forever and ever. And so I took Ants. I saw him pass the schoolhouse 3 or 4 times before I learned that he was driving 4 miles out of his way to do it. I noticed then how he was beginning to hump, a tall man and young, so that he looked already like a tall bird hunched in the cold weather on the wagon seat. He would pass the schoolhouse, the wagon creaking slow, his head turning slow to watch the door of the schoolhouse as the wagon passed, until he went on around the curve and out of sight. One day I went to the door and stood there when he passed. When he saw me, he looked quickly away and did not look back again. In the early spring, it was worst. Sometimes I thought that I could not bear it, lying in bed at night with the wild geese going north and their honking coming faint and high and wild out of the wild darkness. And during the day it would seem as though I couldn't wait for the last one to go so I could go down to the spring. And so when I looked up that day and saw Ant standing there in his Sunday clothes, turning his hat round and round in his hands, I said, "If you've got any women folks, why in the world don't they make you get your hair cut?" "I ain't got none," he said. Then he said suddenly, driving his eyes at me like 2 hounds in a strange yard, "That's what I come to see you about." "And make you hold your shoulders up," I said. "You haven't got any?" "But you've got a house. They tell me you've got a house and a good farm. And you live there alone, doing for yourself, do you?" He just looked at me, turning the hat in his hands. "A new house," I said. "Are you going to get married?" And he said again, holding his eyes to mine, "That's what I come to see you about." Later, he told me, "I ain't got no people, so that won't be no worry to you. I don't reckon you can say the same." "No, I have people. In Jefferson." His face fell a little. "Well, I got a little property. I'm four-handed. I got a good, honest name. I know how town folks are, but maybe when they talk to me..." "They might listen," I said, "but they'll be hard to talk to." He was watching my face. "They're in the cemetery." "But your living kin," he said, "they'll be different." "Will they?" I said. "I don't know. I never had any other kind." So I took Ants, and when I knew that I had cash, I knew that living was terrible and that this was the answer to it. That was when I learned that words are no good, that words don't ever fit even what they are trying to say at, When he was born, I knew that motherhood was invented by someone who had to have a word for it, because the ones that had the children didn't care whether there was a word for it or not. I knew that fear was invented by someone that had never had the fear, pride, who never had the pride. I knew that it had been not that they had dirty noses, but that we had had to use one another by words, like spiders dangling by their mouths from a beam, swinging and twisting and never touching, and that only through the blows of the switch could my blood and their blood flow as one stream. I knew that it had been not that my aloneness had to be violated over and over each day, but that it had never been violated until Cash came, not even by ants in the nights. He had a word, too. Love, he called it. But I had been used to words for a long time. I knew that that word was like the others, just a shape to fill a lack. That when the right time came, you wouldn't need a word for that any more than for pride or fear. Cash did not need to say it to me, nor I to him. And I would say, let Ants use it if he wants to. So that it was Ants or love, love or Ants, it didn't matter. I would think that even while I lay with him in the dark and Cash asleep in the cradle within the swing of my hand. I would think that if he were to wake and cry, I would suckle him, too. Ants or love, it didn't matter. My aloneness had been violated and then made whole again by the violation. Time, ants, love, what you will. Outside the circle. Then I found that I had Darl. At first I would not believe it. Then I believed that I would kill Ants. It was as though he had tricked me, hidden within a word like within a paper screen, and struck me in the back through it. But then I realized that I had been tricked by words older than Ants or love, and that the same word had tricked Ants, too, and that my revenge would be that he would never know I was taking revenge. And when Darl was born, I asked Ants to promise to take me back to Jefferson when I died, because I knew that Father had been right, even when he couldn't have known he was right, any more than I could have known I was wrong. Nonsense, Ants said. You and me ain't nigh done trapping yet with just two. He did not know that he was dead then. Sometimes I would lie by him in the dark, here in the land that was now of my blood and flesh, and I would think, Ants. Why ants? Why are you ants? I would think about his name until after a while I could see the word as a shape, a vessel, and I would watch him liquefy and flow into it like cold molasses flowing out of the darkness into the vessel until the jar stood full and motionless. A significant shape profoundly without life, like an empty door frame. And then I would find that I had forgotten the name of the jar. I would think, the shape of my body where I used to be a virgin is in the shape of a... And I couldn't think ants, couldn't remember ants. It was not that I could think of myself as no longer unvirgin, because I was three now. And when I would think Cash and Darl that way until their names would die and solidify into a shape and then fade away, I would say, all right, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what they call them. And so when Cora Tull would tell me I was not a true mother, I would think how words go straight up in a thin line, quick and harmless, and how terribly doing goes along the earth, clinging to it, so that after a while the two lines are too far apart for the same person to straddle from one to the other. And that sin and love and fear are just sounds that people who never sinned nor loved nor feared have for what they never had and cannot have until they forget the words. Like Cora, who could never even cook. She would tell me what I owed to my children and to Anse and to God. I gave Anse the children. I did not ask for them. I did not even ask him for what he could have given me. Not Anse. That was my duty to him, to not ask that. And that duty I fulfilled. I would be I. I would let him be the shape and echo of his word. That was more than he asked, because he could not have asked for that and been Anse, using himself so with a word.
Disc 5.
That was more than he asked, because he could not have asked for that and been Anse, using himself so with a word. And then he died. He did not know he was dead. I would lie by him in the dark, hearing the dark land talking of God's love and his beauty and his sin, hearing the dark voicelessness in which the words are the deeds and the other words that are not deeds, that are just the gaps in people's lacks, coming down like the cries of the geese out of the wild darkness in the old terrible nights, fumbling at the deeds like orphans to whom are pointed out in a crowd two faces and told, "That is your father, your mother." I believed that I had found it. I believed that the reason was the duty to the alive, to the terrible blood, the red, bitter flood boiling through the land. I would think of sin as I would think of the clothes we both wore in the world's face, of the circumspection necessary because he was he and I was I. The sin the more utter and terrible, since he was the instrument ordained by God who created the sin to sanctify that sin he had created. While I waited for him in the woods, waiting for him before he saw me, I would think of him as dressed in sin. I would think of him as thinking of me as dressed also in sin, he the more beautiful, since the garment which he had exchanged for sin was sanctified. I would think of the sin as garments which we would remove in order to shape and coerce the terrible blood to the forlorn echo of the dead word high in the air. Then I would lay with Anse again. I did not lie to him. I just refused. Just as I refused my breast to Cash and Darl after their time was up, hearing the dark land talking the voiceless speech. I hid nothing. I tried to deceive no one. I would not have cared. I merely took the precautions that he thought necessary for his sake, not for my safety, but just as I wore clothes in the world's face. And I would think then, when Cora talked to me, of how the high dead words in time seemed to lose even the significance of their dead sound. Then it was over. Over in the sense that he was gone, and I knew that, see him again though I would never again see him coming swift and secret to me in the woods, dressed in sin like a gallant garment, already blowing aside with the speed of his secret coming. But for me, it was not over. I mean, over in the sense of beginning and ending. Because to me there was no beginning nor ending to anything then. I even held Anse refraining still, not that I was holding him recessional, but as though nothing else had ever been. My children were of me alone, of the wild blood boiling along the earth, of me and of all that lived, of none and of all. Then I found that I had Jewel. When I waked to remember to discover it, he was 2 months gone. My father said that the reason for living is getting ready to stay dead. I knew at last what he meant, and that he could not have known what he meant himself, because a man cannot know anything about cleaning up the house afterward. And so I have cleaned my house. With Jewel, I lay by the lamp holding up my own head, watching him cap and suture it before he breathed. The wild blood boiled away, and the sound of it ceased. Then there was only the milk, warm and calm, and I lying calm in the slow silence, getting ready to clean my house. I gave Aunt's Dewey Dell to Negative Jewel. Then I gave him Vardaman to replace the child I had robbed him of. And now he has 3 children that are his and not mine. And then I could get ready to die. One day I was talking to Cora. She prayed for me because she believed I was blind to sin, wanting me to kneel and pray too. Because people to whom sin is just a matter of words, to them, salvation is just words too.
Whitfield. When they told me she was dying, all that night I wrestled with Satan, and I emerged victorious. I woke to the enormity of my sin. I saw the true light at last, and I fell on my knees and confessed to God and asked his guidance and received it. "Rise," he said, "repair to that home in which you have put a living lie, among those people with whom you have outraged my word. Confess your sin aloud. It is for them, for that deceived husband, to forgive you, not I." So I went. I heard that Tull's Bridge was gone. I said, "Thanks, O Lord, O mighty ruler of all. For by those dangers and difficulties which I should have to surmount, I saw that he had not abandoned me, and that my reception again into his holy peace and love would be the sweeter for it. Just let me not perish before I have begged the forgiveness of the man whom I betrayed," I prayed. "Let me not be too late. Let not the tale of mine and her transgression come from her lips instead of mine." She had sworn then that she would never tell it, but eternity is a fearsome thing to face. Have I not wrestled thigh to thigh with Satan myself? Let me not have also the sin of her broken vow upon my soul. Let not the waters of thy mighty wrath encompass me until I have cleansed my soul in the presence of them whom I injured. It was his hand that bore me safely above the flood, that fended from me the dangers of the waters. My horse was frightened, and my own heart failed me as the logs and the uprooted trees bore down upon my littleness. But not my soul. Time after time I saw them averted at destruction's final instant, and I lifted my voice above the noise of the flood. "Praise to thee, O mighty Lord and King! By this token shall I cleanse my soul and gain again into the fold of thy undying love." I knew then that forgiveness was mine, the flood, the danger behind. And as I rode on across the firm earth again, and the scene of my Gethsemane grew closer and closer, I framed the words which I should use. I would enter the house. I would stop her before she had spoken. I would say to her husband, "Anse, I have sinned. Do with me as you will. It was already as though it were done. My soul felt freer, quieter than it had in years. Already I seemed to dwell and abide in peace again as I rode on. To either side I saw his hand. In my heart I could hear his voice. Courage, I am with thee. Then I reached Tull's house. His youngest girl came out and called to me as I was passing. She told me that she was already dead. I have sinned, O Lord. Thou knowest the extent of my remorse and the will of my spirit. But he is merciful. He will accept the will for the deed. Who knew that when I framed the words of my confession, it was to Anse I spoke them, even though he was not there? It was he, in his infinite wisdom, that restrained the tale from her dying lips as she lay surrounded by those who loved and trusted her. Mine the travail by water, which I sustained by the strength of his hand. Praise to thee in thy bounteous and omnipotent love. O, praise! I entered the house of bereavement, the lowly dwelling where another erring mortal lay while her soul faced the awful and irrevocable judgment, peace to her ashes. God's grace upon this house, I said.
Darl. On the horse he rode up to Armstead's and came back on the horse, leading Armstead's team. We hitched up and laid Cash on top of Addy. When we laid him down, he vomited again, but he got his head over the wagon bed in time. "He'd taken a lick in the stomach, too," Vernon said. "The horse may have kicked him in the stomach, too," I said. "Did he kick you in the stomach, Cash?" He tried to say something. Dewey Dell wiped his mouth again. "What's he say?" Vernon said. "What is it, Cash?" Dewey Dell said. She leaned down. "His tools," she said. Vernon got them and put them into the wagon. Dewey Dell lifted Cash's head so he could see. We drove on, Dewey Dell and I sitting beside Cash to steady him, and he riding on ahead on the horse. Vernon stood watching us for a while. Then he turned and went back toward the bridge. He walked gingerly, beginning to flap the wet sleeves of his shirt, as though he had just got wet. He was sitting the horse before the gate. Armstead was waiting at the gate. We stopped, and he got down, and we lifted Cash down and carried him into the house, where Mrs. Armstead had the bed ready. We left her and Dewey Dell undressing him. We followed Pa out to the wagon. He went back and got into the wagon and drove on, we following on foot into the lot. The wetting had helped, because Armstead said, "You're welcome to the house. You can put it there." He followed, leading the horse, and stood beside the wagon, the reins in his hand.
"I thank you," Pa said. "We'll use in the shed yonder. I know it's an imposition on you."
"You're welcome to the house," Armstead said.
He had that wooden look on his face again, that bold, surly, high-colored, rigid look, like his face and eyes were two colors of wood, the wrong one pale and the wrong one dark. His shirt was beginning to dry, but it still clung close upon him when he moved.
"She would appreciate it," Pa said.
We took the team out and rolled the wagon back under the shed. One side of the shed was open.
"It won't rain under," Armstead said, "but if you'd rather."
Back of the barn was some rusted sheets of tin roofing. We took two of them and propped them against the open side.
"You're welcome to the house," Armstead said.
"I thank you," Pa said. "I'd take it right kind if you'd give them a little snack."
"Sho," Armstead said. Lulu'll have supper ready soon as she gets cash comfortable.
He had gone back to the horse, and he was taking the saddle off, his damp shirt lapping flat to him when he moved. Pa wouldn't come in the house.
"Come in and eat," Armstead said. "It's nigh ready."
"I wouldn't crave nothing," Pa said. "I thank you."
"You come in and dry and eat," Armstead said. "It'll be all right here."
"It's for her," Pa said. "It's for her sake I'm taking the food. I got no team, no nothing. But she will be grateful to e'er a one of you."
"Show," Armstead said. "You folks come in and dry."
But after Armstead gave Pa a drink, he felt better. And when we went in to see about cash, he hadn't come in with us. When I looked back, he was leading the horse into the barn. He was already talking about getting another team, and by supper time, he had good as bought it. He is down there in the barn, sliding fluidly past the gaudy, lunging swirl, into the stall with it. He climbs onto the manger and drags the hay down, and leaves the stall and seeks and finds the curry comb. Then he returns and slips quickly past the single crashing thump and up against the horse, where it cannot overreach. He applies the curry comb, holding himself within the horse's striking radius with the agility of an acrobat, cursing the horse in a whisper of obscene caress. Its head flashes back, tooth-cropped. Its eyes roll in the dusk like marbles on a gaudy velvet cloth as he strikes it upon the face with the back of the curry comb.
Armstead. But time I give him another sup of whiskey, and supper was about ready. He had done already bought a team from somebody, on a credit. Picking and choosing it were by then, saying how he didn't like this span and wouldn't put his money in nothing so-and-so owned, not even a hen coop. "You might try Snopes," I said. "He's got 3-4 span. Maybe one of them would suit you." Then he begun to mumble his mouth, looking at me like it was me that owned the only span of mules in the county and wouldn't sell them to him, when I knew that like as not it would be my team that would ever get them out of the lot at all. Only I don't know what they would do with them, if they had a team. Little John had told me that the levee through Haley Bottom had done gone for 2 miles and that the only way to get to Jefferson would be to go around by Motson. But that was Ance's business. "He's a close man to trade with," he says, mumbling his mouth. But when I give him another sup after supper, he cheered up some. He was aiming to go back to the barn and set up with her. Maybe he thought that if he just stayed down there ready to take out, Santa Claus would maybe bring him a span of mules. "But I reckon I can talk him around," he says. "A man'll always help a fellow in a tight, if he's got a drop of Christian blood in him." "Of course you're welcome to the use of mine," I said, me knowing how much he believed that was the reason. "I thank you," he said. "She'll want to go in on." And him knowing how much I believe that was the reason. After supper, Jewel rode over to the bend to get Peabody. I heard he was to be there today at Varner's. Jewel come back about midnight. Peabody had gone down below Inverness somewhere, but Uncle Billy come back with him, with a satchel of horse physic. Like he says, a man ain't so different from a horse or a mule, come long, come short, except a mule or a horse has got a little more sense. "What you been into now, boy?" he says, looking at Cash. "Get me a mattress and a chair and a glass of whiskey," he says. He made Cash drink the whiskey, then he run Ants out of the room. "Lucky it was the same leg he broke last summer," Ant says, mournful, mumbling, and blinking. "That's something." We folded the mattress across Cash's legs and set the chair on the mattress, and me and Jewel sat on the chair and the gal held the lamp, and Uncle Billy taken a chew of tobacco and went to work. Cash fought pretty hard for a while, until he fainted. Then he laid still, with big balls of sweat standing on his face like they had started to roll down and then stopped to wait for him. When he waked up, Uncle Billy had done packed up and left. He kept on trying to say something until the gal leaned down and wiped his mouth. "It's his tools," she said. "I brought them in," Darl said. "I got them." He tried to talk again. She leaned down. "He wants to see them," she said. So Darl brought them in where he could see them. They shoved them under the side of the bed where he could reach his hand and touch them when he felt better. Next morning, Ants taken that horse and rode over to the bend to see Snopes. Him and Jewel stood in the lot talking a while. Then Ants got on the horse and rode off. I reckon that was the first time Jewel ever let anybody ride that horse. And until Ants come back, he hung around in that swole-up way, watching the road like he was half a mind to take out after Ants and get the horse back. Along toward 9 o'clock, it begun to get hot. That was when I see the first buzzard. Because of the wetting, I reckon. Anyway, it wasn't until well into the day that I see them. Lucky the breeze was setting away from the house, so it wasn't until well into the morning. But soon as I see them, it was like I could smell it in the field a mile away from just watching them, and them circling and circling for everybody in the county to see what was in my barn. I was still a good half a mile from the house when I heard that boy yelling. I thought maybe he might have fell into the well or something, so I whipped up and come into the lot on the lope. There must have been a dozen of them setting along the ridgepole of the barn, and that boy was chasing another one around the lot like it was a turkey, and it just lifting enough to dodge him and go flopping back to the roof of the shed again where he had found it setting on the coffin. It had got hot then, right, and the breeze had dropped or changed or something. So I went and found Jewel, but Lula come out. "You got to do something," she said. "It's an outrage." "That's what I aim to do," I said. "It's an outrage," she said. "He should be lawed for treating her so." "He's getting her into the ground the best he can," I said. So I found Jewel and asked him if he didn't want to take one of the mules and go over to the bend and see about Ants. He didn't say nothing. He just looked at me with his jaws going bone white and them bone white eyes of his'n. Then he went and begun to call Darl. "What you fixin' to do?" I said. He didn't answer. Darl come out. "Come on," Jewel said. "What you aim to do?" Darl said. "Going to move the wagon," Jewel said over his shoulder. "Don't be a fool," I said. "I never meant nothing. You couldn't help it." And Darl hung back, too, but nothing wouldn't suit Jewel. "Shut your goddamn mouth," he says. "It's got to be somewhere," Darl said. "We'll take out soon as Pa gets back." "You won't help me?" Jewel says, them white eyes of his'n kind of blaring and his face shaking like he had an auger. "No," Darl said, "I won't. Wait till Pa gets back." So I stood in the door and watched him push and haul at that wagon. It was on a downhill, and once I thought he was fixing to beat out the back end of the shed. Then the dinner bell rung. I called him, but he didn't look around. "Come on to dinner," I said. "Tell that boy." but he didn't answer. So I went on to dinner. The gal went down to get that boy, but she come back without him. About half through dinner, we heard him yelling again, running that buzzard out. "It's an outrage," Lula said, "an outrage." "He's doing the best he can," I said. "A fella don't trade with Snopes in 30 minutes. They'll sit in the shade all afternoon to dicker." "Do?" she says. "Do? He's done too much already." And I reckon he had. Trouble is, his quitting was just about to start out doing. He couldn't buy no team from nobody, let alone Snopes, withouten he had something to mortgage he didn't know would mortgage yet. And so when I went back to the field, I looked at my mules and same as told them goodbye for a spell. And when I come back that evening and the sun shining all day on that shed, I wasn't so sure I would regret it. He come riding up just as I went out to the porch, where they all was. He looked kind of funny, kind of more hangdog than common, and kind of proud, too. Like he had done something he thought was cute but wasn't so sure now how other folks would take it. "I got a team," he said. "You bought a team from Snopes?" I said. "I reckon Snopes ain't the only man in this country that can drive a trade," he said. "Sure," I said. He was looking at Jewel with that funny look, but Jewel had done got down from the porch and was going toward the horse to see what Ants had done to it, I reckon. "Jewel," Ant says. Jewel looked back. "Come here," Ant says. Jewel come back a little and stopped again. "What you want?" he said. "So you got a team from Snopes," I said. "He'll send them over tonight, I reckon. You want an early start tomorrow, long as you'll have to go by Motson." Then he quit looking like he had been for a while. He got that badgered look like he used to have, mumbling his mouth. "I do the best I can," he said. "For God, if there were e'er man in the living world suffer the trials and floutings I have suffered. A fella that just beat Snopes in a trade ought to feel pretty good," I said. "What did you give him, Ance?" He didn't look at me. "I give a chattel mortgage on my cultivator and cedar," he said. "But they ain't worth $40. How far do you aim to get with a $40 team?" They were all watching him now, quiet and steady. Jewel was stopped halfway back, waiting to go on to the horse. "I give other things," Ant said. He began to mumble his mouth again, standing there like he was waiting for somebody to hit him and him with his mind already made up not to do nothing about it. "What other things?" Dahl said. "Hell," I said, "you take my team. You can bring them back. I'll get along some way." "So that's what you were doing in Cash's clothes last night," Dahl said. He said it just like he was reading it out in the paper. Like he never give a darn himself one way or the other. Jewel had come back now, standing there, looking at Ants with them marble eyes of his'n. "Cash aimed to buy that talking machine from Surratt with that money," Dahl said. Ants stood there, mumbling his mouth. Jewel watched him. He ain't never blinked yet. "But that's just $8 more," Dahl said, in that voice like he was just listening and never give a darn himself. "That still won't buy a team." Ants looked at Jewel quick, kind of sliding his eyes that way. Then he looked down again. "God knows if there were e'er man," he says. Still, they didn't say nothing. They just watched him, waiting, and him sliding his eyes toward their feet and up their legs, but no higher. And the horse, he says. What horse? Jules said. Ants just stood there. I'd be darned if a man can't keep the upper hand.